revivalist spirituals, the call and response or holler songs of African slaves. All of these went into the mixing pot of the early blues. Early blues singers moulded tunes with African inflections in them onto chords borrowed from American hymns, parlour, folk and vaudeville songs. But there were other African ingredients too, such as use of the akonting, the plucked folk lute used for accompanying solo singers, and which, alongside the Arab-inspired Spanish guitar, is a parent instrument of the banjo. The fact that there were European elements in the DNA of the blues should not surprise us. It had been nearly a century since new slaves had arrived in America from Africa, and the music that Americans of all backgrounds heard and shared in the second half of the 19th century was already well blended. There has been considerable research into song forms of the poorest Americans of all ethnic groups, particularly in Peter van der Merwe's seminal Origins of the Popular Style, which has revealed the extent of the influence of Anglo-Celtic folk music on song types in the growth of the blues. Not only had the distinctive flattened thirds and sevenths been a feature of Anglo-Celtic folk music since long before the Tudors, but Anglo-Celtic song types, picked up from the slaves and emancipated slaves' co-workers, vast numbers of whom were from the British Isles, are also known to have been influential. Among these song types are hundreds that lament the burden and misery of underclass life, as became the standard blues format. The particular lyrical stanza shape of what became the 12-bar blues, for instance, has been traced to templates derived from the 17th century folk songs The Cruel Ship's Carpenter and Pretty Polly via a 19th century work song called Poor Lazarus, also known as O Brother, Where Art Thou? Likewise, the iconic 19th century American work song The Ballad of John Henry, the Steel Driving Man, which itself became a blues standard and which commemorates the futile battle between a black railroad worker and a new machine designed to replace him, can be traced back as a pattern to the much earlier British ballad The Birmingham Boys. It is entirely understandable that there should be sensitivity about the non-African elements in the origin of the blues, since the music of the slaves, from which it sprang, was so often a lament or protestation against the harsh treatment they received. But music does not observe racial or national boundaries. It is, as we have seen repeatedly, open and available to all cultures, owned by none. Whatever elements went into its kit of parts, the early blues musicians made something unique and lasting of their own. The issue of ownership in the breakneck speed of growth and dissemination of popular music styles was to recur time and time again in the 20th century, with the poorest, least visible musicians often finding their creativity swallowed up in the commercial exploitation that went with it. The intermingling of styles and traditions that gave birth to the blues can be seen in the arrival, at around the same time, of rag or ragtime music, which reached its apogee in the sheet music publications of Scott Joplin, 1867 to 1917. It had originated in the bars and brothels of St. Louis in Chicago, where house pianists copied the marching band style popularised in the 1880s and 90s by bandleaders such as John Philip Sousa. In order to emulate a whole band, bass, accompanying chords and tune, the solo pianist had to leap about the keys frantically, resulting in a rather virtuoso left-hand motion from bass to chord and back. On top of this accompanying oompah, the rag pianists wove a catchy tune that pulled the rhythm around, a technique called syncopation. Syncopation is like talking with the emphasis on the wrong words to create a jerky sound. Ragtime picked up this playful jumping ahead of the tune from the banjo or piano accompaniments for cakewalks, also called chalk line walks, parodic dancing competitions held by African-American communities during which coconut cake may have been offered as a prize. Debussy, in Paris, cashed in on the popularity of cakewalk piano rags with his Gollywog's Cakewalk of 1908, which, incidentally, also includes a jokey musical quotation from Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. Ragtime's syncopation fed directly into an energetic, driving piano style of the 1920s known as stride. The style was made famous in Harlem by the pianistic wizard James P. Johnson, a quintessential stride performance of his being Harlem Strut of 1921. Ragtime's revolutionary love child, though, was a hyper-syncopated form of piano and band playing that flickered into life in the 1910s in the Storyville district of New Orleans, and which charismatic performers like Jelly Roll Morton took on tour around the southern states in travelling vaudeville shows. Though Jelly Roll called a lot of his numbers blues, we now know this as the beginning of a distinct genre of its own, jazz. The etymology of the term jazz is hotly debated, but the most likely derivation is from a non-musical 19th century slang word, jazzm, meaning energy, vigour or liveliness. Its choice of instruments, cornet, trombone, clarinet and tuba, supported by banjo, drums and sometimes piano, was heavily influenced by the practical windfall of an injection of cheap ex-military band stock at the end of the 1898 Spanish-American War. Some elements of the marching band style remained in the formation of street bands for funeral processions and for dancing, though these bands had a cheerful anarchy to them, each lead instrument taking its turn to improvise solos around the established chordal pattern or tune. The New Orleans prototypes acquired the generic label Dixieland after the huge success of a band called the Original Dixieland Jazz or Jazz Band, whose 1917 hit Livery Stable Blues sold a million copies. Despite jazz's African-American origins in the blues and in New Orleans's funeral procession bands, the members of the Original Dixieland Jazz Band itself were the children of white European immigrants. But as jazz spread from the Red Light Basin Street area of New Orleans to the clubs of Chicago and New York, thriving in Prohibition-era speakeasies, it provided mobility most of all to black musicians who made up the critical mass of its player pool. Indeed, the spread of jazz into northern and midwestern cities had coincided with the massively increased availability of wartime factory work, which had encouraged mass black migration in the same direction. Soon, the urban black working class would also have money in their pockets to buy the records of the jazz artists whose success for the first time proved that the American dream might yet have some meaning for African Americans after all. Up to this point in musical history, the first few years of the 20th century, ethnic folk elements had been co-opted into classical music as subsidiary exotic flavouring. With the emergence of jazz, all this was to change. The unavoidable historical truth is that, despite their best efforts, and they were damn fine efforts, make no mistake, the classically trained composers of the early 20th century were to be totally outflanked by the newer genres of blues and jazz, which, as they made common cause with popular songwriters of exceptional skill and panache, swept all before them. Once the choice of which music thrived passed into the hands of an audience of millions through recording and later broadcasting, new priorities very rapidly started to prevail. Popular music was taking centre stage, while classical music began to move into the slipstream. How was classical music going to respond to this new, potentially fatal relationship between mass audiences and new genres that were irresistible to them? Was this a schism too far for the already reeling Western tradition to handle? Not quite. Faced with the twin rebellions of dissonant modernism and the mass market, the classical tradition found an ace up its sleeve and played it with impeccable timing. In a world of turmoil and change, its response was nostalgia. A work like Elgar's Enigma Variations of 1899 typifies this response. Self-consciously backward-looking in its thematic intentions, comprising as it does a series of affectionate portraits of his friends and family, as well as its musical character, with its homages to Beethoven, Mendelssohn and Brahms. Other interpretations of the nostalgic impulse abound as the 19th century slipped into the 20th. Edvard Grieg's Holberg Suite, 1884, Isaac Albéniz's Three Antique Suites and Suite Española, 1886, Reynaldo Hahn's Caprice Melancolique, 1897, Maurice Ravel's Pavane pour un enfant défunt, 1899, Jan Sibelius's Finlandia, 1899, Karl Reinecke's Serenade in G minor, 1900, Max Bruch's Serenade in A minor, 1900, Hugo Alfvén's Swedish Rhapsody No. 1, Midsummer Vaka, 1903, Enrique Granados's Escenas Románticas, 1904, Elgar's Introduction and Allegro for Strings, 1905, Amy Beach's Suite Française, 1907, Gustav Holst's A Somerset Rhapsody, 1907, Frederick Delius's Brig Fair, 1907, Ralph Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis, 1910, Fritz Kreisler's Liebesfreude and Liebeslied, 1910, and Max Reger's Eine Romantische Suite of 1912. As the world began to slide towards a final showdown of the European empires, this kind of music increasingly reminded people of the way of life they were about to lose. Light after light goes down. England and the kingdom, Britain and the empire, the old prides and the old devotions glide abeam, astern, sink down upon the horizon, pass, pass. The river passes, London passes, England passes. So wrote H.G. Wells, somewhat prophetically, in the conclusion of his semi-autobiographical satire Tono Bungay, 1909. This chapter, describing a warship heading down the Thames, past London's familiar shoreline landmarks towards the open sea, inspired the final elegiac movement of Vaughan Williams's majestic London Symphony, first performed in March 1914 in London, and dedicated to his friend and fellow composer George Butterworth. In what could be described as the first cultural casualty of the Great War, Vaughan Williams sent the score to the conductor Fritz Busch in Germany following this performance, where it was promptly lost in the turmoil of the outbreak of war. It subsequently had to be reconstructed from the orchestral parts. Without doubt, the impending and actual sense of loss motivated British composers in the period before and during the First World War to compose music of outstanding beauty, from Vaughan Williams's heartbreaking The Lark Ascending to Parry's Jerusalem and Songs of Farewell to Holst's Planet Suite, which begins with Mars, the bringer of war. Added to the 1914-18 list should be, by dint of his association with the war, George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow of 1913. He was killed by sniper fire on the Somme in July 1916. The tragedy of the war on so many levels and the apparent unravelling of the certainties of the previous century elicited an unprecedented collective response from British composers. Charles Hubert Parry viewed the war, as did Elgar, from an older generation's perspective, composing a cycle of choral songs of mature, eloquent poignancy in Songs of Farewell. Although Parry survived the war, he died in the influenza epidemic that took 22 million lives worldwide in 1918. There was no shortage of patriotic, empire-extolling music provided by home front composers during the Great War, including Elgar's The Spirit of England and The Fringes of the Fleet, and Ivor Novello's Keep the Home Fires Burning. But the two greatest national songs that were the fruit of the conflict, Parry's Jerusalem and Jupiter from Holst's Planets, the big tune from which was adapted by him to become I Vow to Thee My Country in 1921, using Cecil Spring Rice's poetic response to the human sacrifice of the war, were not traditional jingoistic anthems, as one might expect. Rather, they were thoughtful challenges to conscience and faith, that asked as many questions as they provided answers. While the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 had provoked in its wake a defensive, nationalistic reaction from composers in France and hundreds of pages of Teutonic vitriol from Wagner, the growing internationalism of music, the intermingling of genres, the easier availability of travel and the growing mass market for records ensured that the great broadening of horizons that had begun before the Great War was, this time, unstoppable, even in the face of such devastation and loss. The 20th century's musical adventure was just getting into its stride. Chapter 7. The Popular Age 1. 1918-1945. On Christmas Eve 1906, from a wind-lashed transmitting station overlooking the Atlantic Ocean at Brant Rock, Massachusetts, A momentous sound was heard. It was the first ever wireless broadcast of a piece of recorded music. Ombra Mai Fu, Handel's Largo, transmitted by an intrepid radio pioneer named Reginald Fessenden. The intended recipients of this broadcast, a term not yet coined for radio transmission and subsequently borrowed from farming, were Fessenden's colleagues at a specially constructed receiving station on the west coast of Scotland, but this had recently been destroyed in a storm. Consequently, the programme was picked up, to their amazement, by ships at sea. The test broadcast went unreported for some time, but it was nonetheless the first tentative step towards a new age for music. By 1922, 10 million American households owned a radio receiver, up from just 60,000 in 1919, many of which were homemade crystal sets. 600 broadcasters fueled the boom, with Chicago's KYW broadcasting nightly operas from 1921 onwards, and light fare outside the opera season. Meanwhile, in Argentina, a radio station had in August 1920 transmitted a live performance of Wagner's Parsifal from the Teatro Coliseo in Buenos Aires to the fewer than 30 households in the city with radios able to hear it. Over in Britain, the world's first national broadcaster, the BBC, came into being in 1922, ushering in an age when music would come to belong to everyone, everywhere, often enjoyed completely for free. In the USA, advertising was in fact paying for radio broadcasting from the mid-1920s. In the UK, a radio licence fee was charged by the government to fund the BBC. The advent of free-to-air music for the world's grateful millions would change the value, purpose and style of music more dramatically than any other development in its history, and the dramatic advances in technology in the 20th century affected popular and classical music in very different ways. For pop, broadcast technology stimulated a thirst for new sounds and new voices that proliferated vigorously across the world. The explosion of popular songwriting, from George Gershwin and Cole Porter in the 1920s to Dylan and Lennon and McCartney in the 1960s, Stevie Wonder in the 1970s, Michael Jackson in the 1980s, Prince in the 1990s, and Bruno Mars and Adele in our own time, is a glorious, life-affirming phenomenon. The popular age, as it rapidly became known, brought undreamed-of musical benefits and rewards to humankind. But pop's success also provoked a concern, voiced in every decade since 1900, that it had wittingly or unwittingly brought about the near extinction of other, older forms of music, an accusation specifically levelled at jazz by the writer, conductor and composer Constant Lambert, musical director of the Vic Wells, later Royal Ballet, in his widely read book Music Ho, 1934. It didn't help that non-popular music was generically becoming known as classical music, a term that began circulating in the 1930s as a marketing distinction used by record companies hoping to target listeners through the genres they preferred. The label was, initially at least, intended to grant the Western art music of approximately 1600 to 1900 a deferential sheen of permanence and class, but by the 1960s, it had come to mean, for many millions, simply old-fashioned. That a whole genre of music acquired a description that said antique and formal, when it was often startlingly new, young or informal, was indicative, so many believed, that the music they loved was being deliberately sidelined in mainstream culture. To be fair, as many, if not more, disliked what they saw as the ghetto of the genre term folk music. That one branch of the family tree had begun to own the term popular was to many classical music aficionados in itself a revealing and disturbing fact of life. Is it true that classical music has been slowly suffocated in its sleep over the past 100 years? I would say emphatically not. I hope to show in these final two chapters that, despite taking the odd experimental cul-de-sac on its journey, classical music has been alive and well since Reginald Fessenden's test broadcast. It has changed, certainly, and it's now experienced in all sorts of ways that would have surprised, for instance, Edvard Grieg, the Norwegian composer who died a few months after that historic transmission. But classical music's DNA is also embedded everywhere in the popular mainstream, whether in the stage musical, the cinema, or in the albums of, say, The Beatles, Paul Simon, The Verve, or Alicia Keys. Of course, music has always had its tribal loyalties and its audience stratification. It is conceivable that a few people in 1875 would have sought out tickets for and relished with equal pleasure the openings of Bizet's Carmen in Paris, Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury in London, Richard Wagner's concert version of Goethe Dämmerung in Vienna, Ponchielli's cantata Omaggio a Donizetti in Bergamo, or squeezed themselves into one of Greater London's 375 music halls. But in general, the audiences at these events would mostly have been people of different tastes and classes. The stylistic parting of ways that started to become evident in the early 20th century, though, was on an unprecedented scale. This wasn't just about record-buying preferences, either. Being a composer in the 20th century meant making career-defining choices that simply were not relevant to earlier generations. A highly skilled, celebrated musician of the 1920s, such as Cole Porter, interacted with his vast public in clubs, bars, theatres, cinemas and dance halls, a party to which everyone was, in effect, invited, in a manner that was a universe away from the invitation-only aristocratic salons of Vienna's imperial palaces, where Mozart and Haydn were compelled to ply their trade. The inheritors of Mozart's legacy in the 20th century, classically trained, self-styled, serious composers, struggled desperately with this challenge. After all, if you're not popular in a popular age, what are you for? The anxiety that underpins such a question can be seen playing itself out time and time again, and it's an anxiety that has often led classical musicians and their fans to look with disdain upon their counterparts in the popular field. The awkward exchange between the two worlds was addressed with unintentionally prophetic poignancy at a concert given at Aeolian Hall in New York in February 1924. Indeed, the event was something like a musical equivalent of nuclear fusion. The point of the concert, an experiment in modern music, whose programme had an exhausting 26 different items, was educational. The third of three concerts designed to convince critics and the concert-going public that jazz was America's modern music and worthy of serious consideration. Led by the classically trained jazz bandleader Paul Whiteman, the concert was designed to bring about some kind of rapprochement between the two genres and to show that jazz would develop from the rougher New Orleans Dixie style towards an orchestral milieu in the near future. The highbrow world of classical music would be presented with examples of how various forms of jazz might work in a proper concert hall setting, as if to say, one day jazz will grow up and will be respected like Beethoven. At the same time, Whiteman hoped the kind of people who liked jazz might discover that a formal concert hall wasn't so scary and unapproachable after all, and might be encouraged to come again to a more conventional symphony concert. In the event, the concert became famous for one reason only. One of the composers Whiteman approached to compose something hybrid that straddled jazz and classical was George Gershwin, who, just before the final item, Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance Marches, premiered a work he had composed in just 5 weeks, Rhapsody in Blue. By the end of its 14 minutes, the world of music had changed forever. In one sense, those 14 minutes tell the story of the next 50 years. The upstart popular musicians invited to bow at the altar of high art were at first dismissed by critics, despite having delighted the audience. A typically snooty review of Rhapsody in Blue's premiere appeared in the following morning's New York Tribune. How trite, feeble and conventional the tunes are. How sentimental and vapid the harmonic treatment. Weep over the lifelessness of the melody and harmony, so derivative, so stale, so inexpressive. But great music has a way of finding its voice whatever snobbery throws at it, and what happened next is that Gershwin's first recording of Rhapsody in Blue, made 3 years later in 1927, sold 1 million copies within a year. It's now one of the standard pieces in every orchestra's repertoire, an out-and-out modern classic. In the 30-odd years between December 1893, when Czech patriot Dvořák's New World Symphony had its premiere at Carnegie Hall, conducted by an eminent Hungarian, and Paul Whiteman's Experiment in Modern Music at Aeolian Hall in February 1924, the status of homegrown music in the United States had changed beyond recognition, largely due to the country having become the crucible of vibrant new forms of popular music. Race issues still scarred civil society, certainly, but one problem that Americans were happy to live without was the blight that ravaged Europe in the 1920s, 30s and 40s, militant nationalism. So many American composers of the early 20th century were immigrants or the children of immigrants whose prior national identities were willfully abandoned in the rush to find an American sound in their music. It was quite another story over in Europe, where one gruesome incident in 1927, the same year as Gershwin's frontier-busting Rhapsody in Blue sold a million copies, provides a glaring demonstration of the widening gulf between the two continents. It concerns the remains of composer and cellist Luigi Boccherini, a contemporary of Mozart and Haydn, who was born in the Italian city of Lucca, but who settled in Spain as a young man, marrying twice and having six children there. He was buried with his family in Madrid, his descendants putting down roots in Spain that persisted into the 20th century. Some of Boccherini's most memorable and utterly enchanting chamber music is a collection called Musica Notturna della Strada di Madrid, Musical Nights in the Streets of Madrid. Nonetheless, and sidestepping the details of Boccherini's actual life, Mussolini decided in 1927 that the remains of an Italian-born composer of nearly 200 years earlier should be dug up and brought back to Lucca. This gesture, forcing a national identity upon someone whose music was filled with the colour, rhythm and spirit of his adopted home, would have been ludicrous and ignorant in any age, but in the 20th century, when music escaped from its boundaries with a vengeance, it was hollow, petty and meaningless. It may be a cliché, but the melting pot of the United States proved, in its domination of 20th century music, that leaving behind nationalistic distinctions in search of a collective voice was by far the more fruitful way forward. In the years between the First World War and the disinterring of Luigi Boccherini's bones, music's family had expanded prolifically. Even before the war, a third of all homes in Great Britain alone had a record player. In 1914, 27 million records were sold. By 1921, that figure had reached 100 million. A method of synchronising sound with film was unveiled in 1922, the year the BBC was founded, and in 1926, Warner Brothers released Don Juan, the first Hollywood film containing a musical score embedded on the film's soundtrack. Nor was music seen as a background supplement to films. In big cities, before musical sound could be integrated into the film itself, cinema audiences would be treated to the lavish sight and sound of a live orchestra playing a score composed specially for the action on screen. For many people, this would have been their first experience of a live orchestra playing what was, in all but name, classical music. In smaller cinemas, a pianist or organist would provide a similarly live accompaniment. Russian classical composer Dmitri Shostakovich supported himself in Leningrad in 1924 and 5 by doing just that. It's worth noting that the man who more than anyone launched Hollywood's worldwide success, Charlie Chaplin, was also composer for his films, with and without sound. His first commercial venture after moving to the United States as a music hall performer was to set up a music publishing company. Chaplin's first film with a synchronised music soundtrack was City Lights, released in 1931, for which he also composed five songs in addition to the score. Thereafter, as well as composing for all his subsequent films, Chaplin wrote and recorded retrospective scores for his earlier silent films, continuing to do so well into the 1970s. In 1921, Ubi Blake's Shuffle Along became the first musical comedy written by African-Americans and starring African-Americans to run successfully on Broadway. Its hit song, I'm Just Wild About Harry, lyric by Noble Sissel, challenged a racial taboo of the time by featuring a romantic duet between two black characters. Blake, who was from Maryland, was the only surviving child of eight, born to former slaves, and like Chaplin, he'd learnt his trade as a vaudeville performer. He made his name with ragtime, but this style, as we saw in the previous chapter, was in the early 1920s being superseded all over America by jazz. Indeed, the jazz stars of the 1920s, among them James P. Johnson, Fats Waller, Bessie Smith, King Oliver, Fletcher Henderson, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, were, alongside Hollywood's biggest names, becoming the best-known celebrities in America. That they had virtually all come from lives of obscurity and poverty is in itself remarkable and a phenomenon rarely witnessed in Western music before the 20th century. When such an incredible change in fortune had occurred in the past, it had typically taken composers and performers a lifetime to achieve a position of prestige, usually among a privileged cognoscenti, and even then their status was rarely recognised by the public at large. The boy Mozart was famous as a child prodigy, to be sure, but famous in this context meant attracting comment and wonderment for brief spells at various royal courts of Europe. Ordinary, working-class Europeans would not have known who Mozart was, either during his life or for a long time after it. The fame enjoyed by the first jazz celebrities, however, was of an unheard-of scale, both in terms of the rapidity of their ascent and the millions of listeners who became intimately familiar with them and their music, thanks to radio, records and films. Duke Ellington, grandson of a former slave, began with his band a four-year residency at New York's Hollywood Club in 1923. In the same year, Louis Armstrong, born into abject poverty in New Orleans and also the grandson of slaves, was playing cornet for King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band in Chicago, making records, earning good money and living in his own apartment. There were precious few opportunities for young black men in the segregated America of the 1920s, yet through music, these two men became icons. The historic transformation of music in the jazz age was enabling an equally historic, admittedly embryonic, social transformation. That it was a change on a grand scale is undeniable. Historian Eric Hobsbawm, in The Jazz Scene, 1959, estimated that on the eve of the Great Depression there were a staggering 60,000 jazz bands containing 200,000 professional musicians in America. Jazz celebrity though he was, Duke Ellington disliked his music being pigeonholed as jazz. He preferred simply to call it American music, and he experimented in many forms and genres. He had a point. From the very beginning, jazz as a style thwarted definition, so various were its manifestations in different places. The convergent tendency of 20th century music was manifest even in its most infant genre, articulated by its most eloquent spokesperson. Jazz was born defying categorisation, even as white critics in journals were trying their toxic best to exclude it from serious study. A New York Times editorial of 1924 dismissed it as a return to the humming, hand-clapping or tom-tom beating of savages. It's hardly surprising that a genre that consciously eluded form, which chose improvisation over the printed page, which allowed maximum freedom and looseness in its harmony, its interpretation of melody and its rhythm, should have splintered into 100 colourful shards on impact with the world. In all fields of music, the do-as-you-please freedom of the Roaring Twenties gave way to more organised, ordered forms in the 1930s. It's tempting to link this move towards greater organisation and a curbing of carefree individuality to parallel developments in the political temperature of the times, with the rise of dictatorships, or, in a benevolent form, the New Deal programmes of state intervention, directed employment and the rise of trade union solidarity as a response to the fear generated by the meltdown of the Great Depression. More likely, though, conformity of expression gathered momentum because the record-buying, radio-listening public liked it better, and bands reflected the change in fashion for entirely understandable commercial reasons. On top of the demands of radio, the jukebox was another factor in the slimming down of rambling jazz sessions. By 1937, there were 150,000 jukeboxes in America, further stimulating the market for record buying. In jazz, the shift in emphasis meant bigger bands, comprising more structured families of instruments, playing well-honed, written-out arrangements, with occasional, well-defined solos emerging from the texture. Greater shape and clarity, of course, was what the fledgling record industry preferred to long-winded periods of virtuoso meandering. It wanted tracks that could be packaged and contained on one side of a 78 shellac, ideas contained in catchy 3 or 4 minute bursts, as in Ellington's 1928 hit Digga Digga Doo, a pragmatic consideration that continues to this day, despite the freedom from time constraints afforded by digital technology. The 3 minute convention persists, thanks in no small part to attention spans and radio playlist imperatives. The prevailing style of the 1930s and 40s, nurtured initially in the mob-run entertainment hub of the South, Kansas City, was both called swing and had a swing to it, though nailing down a definition of swing that all its practitioners would have agreed on has always been rather a minefield. Moreover, since swing is a technique that is felt by the player in performance rather than written down and rehearsed methodically, like most of music's other rhythmic features, its application is deliberately non-standardised. It is, in this respect, not dissimilar to the nuance of accent when learning a language. It's relatively straightforward to learn from a book the vocabulary, idiom and grammar of a foreign language, but speaking it like a native is only possible by spending years immersed in the sound and interplay of the language as it's spoken every day. There are two chief ingredients in swing. One of these is the syncopation we've already encountered in ragtime, whereby the melody, it is usually the melody, though inner parts of the music and even the steady bass line may be susceptible, trips ahead and falls behind the point where the beat is expected to fall. Syncopation was immediately apparent in, and essential to, ragtime style, where just one player provided both the regular pulse and the cheeky push and pull against it, the right hand being mischievous with the steadiness of the left. Ragtime's syncopation was drawn from a relatively limited menu of possible variations, and could therefore also be written down and mastered, in time, by any competent pianist. As it was passed from ragtime to early Dixieland jazz bands, though, syncopation became more sophisticated. Now, instead of the right hand cheating the left, one instrumentalist was playing against another. The possible variations for errant beats multiplied rapidly and unpredictably. The push and pull of anticipating and delaying notes, as manipulated by 2, 3, or 4 improvising musicians, treating the bass and drums as their governing foundation, significantly complicated the layers of syncopation available, giving early jazz its bubbling energy and sense of fun. Indeed, as jazz reached out beyond its localised street gatherings and sleazy clubs, spreading across America and thence to Europe during the First World War, it seemed to listeners and musicians alike that it was a playfully anarchic genre. It had an appealing naughtiness that was provided almost entirely by rhythmic syncopation. The second major component of swing was a lilting effect achieved by subtly shifting the subdivisions of the given four-in-a-bar beat. This effect was not unique to swing, though. It had, by the end of the 19th century, become ubiquitous in music hall, vaudeville and minstrel songs, and, separately, in Latin American dance music. But let's look back briefly at how the popular lilt developed into the swing of swing music. The 19th century had seen a rise in popularity of a lilting form of music known as the habanera in many Central and South American countries, particularly Cuba, with its geographically concentrated, intertwined African, Creole and Hispanic communities. The habanera had been imported by Spain to various of its colonies, but the Spanish had inherited it from the earlier French contradanse, and the French had in turn inherited it from an even earlier English country dance pattern. In fact, the habanera had found its way to Cuba not via the colonial Spanish, who lived very separate lives from the other classes on the island, where slavery was not abolished until 1895, but rather via French-speaking Haitian refugees fleeing slave rebellions and retribution from such rebellions at the very end of the 18th century. A notated form of Cuban habanera, a song called San Pascual Bailón, survives from as early as 1803. Over in Europe, the prototype English country dance and its French contradanse spin-off, in dupal time, two-step, fell from popularity in the 19th century and were replaced by the spectacularly successful triple time, three-step, waltz from Austria, and to an extent, the dupal time polka from Bohemia, which, incidentally, was something of a template for Scott Joplin's Piano Rags. In the later 19th century, however, the habanera was reintroduced to Europe as an exotic dance from Cuba, and it began to reappear in European music. The most celebrated example is the habanera from Bizet's opera Carmen, 1875, in which it forms the accompaniment of the song L'amour est un oiseau rebelle, Love is a rebellious bird. Bizet's habanera was itself an adaptation of a song, El Araglito, by the Spanish composer Sebastián de Iradier, who had visited Cuba in 1861 and been enchanted by its dances. Iradier's other claim to fame is that he wrote La Paloma, the most recorded Spanish song of all time. The habanera and its contradance antecedents had a highly distinctive accompanying rhythm of four beats, which, when broken down in musical notation, sounds, as in the opening of the Bizet song, like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The 2-4 designation at the start of the notation tells us that there are two principal beats in the bar. They fall on the numbers 1 and 5, that can, as here, be subdivided into eight shorter beats known as semiquavers, or 16th notes in music terminology. The fact that there are two principal beats indicates this is a dupal time, two-step dance. In this example, the first note, D, with a duration value of 3 semiquavers, acts as a springboard for the 1 semiquaver second note, ba, ba, which is followed by 2 notes of 2 semiquavers each. In notation, to let you know that the first note is 3 semiquavers long instead of 2, it has a dot added to it, which is why this is called a dotted rhythm. The effect of it is a slightly jerky sound, especially as the first note is in practice not sustained for all of its three beats. Rather, it is shortened to make it spikier and more accented, leaving a little gap between the first and second notes. Bum, 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 bum. Dotted patterns with the skipping rum, ta-tum emphasis they create were very common indeed in European music of the 17th and 18th centuries, especially in France. The royal composers Lully and Rameau, who wrote ballet music for the courts of Louis XIV and XV, were obsessed with dotted rhythms, so much so, in fact, that they favoured a performance practice known as notes inégales, whereby even notes written out as equal, undotted, were assumed to be dotted. We shall return to this assumption very shortly, because its application finds a direct parallel, believe it or not, with swing in the 1930s. By the 19th century, though, a dotted rhythm was only played if the composer had specified it with a dot in the notation. Here, though, a new oddity arose, which I shall demonstrate with the help of a rousing abolitionist song from the American Civil War, John Brown's Body, which was adapted into 1,000 other versions, including the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Its catchy tune is in 4-4 time, that is, it has a steady marching pulse of 4 principal beats per bar. John Brown's Body is a march, and as such you would expect its rhythm to be regimented and precise, with drummers keeping everything in strict order. If I sing how it's written down on the page, it sounds like this. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in his grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in his grave. What is in fact performed and heard is a more lilting version of this rhythm, the lilt produced by a subtle reapportioning of the beat. Thanks to recordings, we know that this has been the case since at least the late 19th century. In the example I've just sung, there are two notes on the word body. Body. The first note, bo, like the first note of our habanera example, in the notation is dotted. So instead of being two semiquavers long, it is three. The next note is just one semiquaver. This makes the two notes rhythmically identical to the first two notes of our habanera example. 3 + 1 = 4 semiquavers. Bo-ho-ho-di. The four principal beats of our bar are known as crotchets. Each crotchet is made up of four semiquavers, and we can use these crotchets to track where the strong or accented beats fall. The highlighted words that I'm going to say are the beats on which our feet would step if we were marching to the song. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in his grave. But although body, for example, is marked as being 3 + 1 semiquavers, making a total of 4, the lilting variation of this song that became the norm in performance and which you are playing in your head as you read this does not divide each of the crotchets into 4 subdivisions, 4 semiquavers, but rather into 3. Subdividing a beat by 3 instead of 4 naturally makes each of the new smaller beats slightly longer. Now the mathematical value for body is 2 + 1. The audible result of this slight increase in length of each subdivision is that the rhythm feels more relaxed, smoother, and less rigidly precise. So we sing, John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in his grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in his grave. In notation, the body is now written out as a triplet, not as 3 semiquavers plus a fourth. This triplet reorganisation, 2 + 1, of what might otherwise have been a 3 + 1 pulse, underpins an enormous number of popular parlour and music hall songs of the turn of the 20th century, from I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside to Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow and Hinky Dinky Parley-Voo. It runs through all these songs because it is a natural pattern of rhymed spoken English. It is the rhythm, for instance, of Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, which dates from the English Civil War. This lolloping rhythm also became a major component of swing rhythm, and the funny thing is that it still isn't written down. All songs, however jazzy, are transcribed in notation with the archaic dotted version. But 2 + 1 instead of 3 + 1 is always implied. In this respect, the 2 + 1 triplet has become as habitual to post-jazz popular song as the unwritten notes inégales were to the dance music of Lully and Rameau. The swung triplet is absent from the surviving recordings of Scott Joplin playing in ragtime, but it can be heard tentatively in early jazz. Its swagger detected in the original Dixieland jazz band's Sudan, also called Oriental Jazz and Oriental Jazz, which was recorded and released in London in May 1920. By the time of Benny Moten's Kansas City Shuffle of December 1926, the triplet-driven beat has acquired a new name, shuffle, and is heading towards absolute universality in the 1930s swing craze. Art Tatum's dazzling acrobatic solo piano version of T for Two, March 1933, demonstrates how one man could syncopate, swing, shuffle and solo without the need for drums, bass and guitar to provide the rhythmic foundation. A particularly clear example of the swing dynamic can be found in Count Basie's 1 o'clock jump of July 1937, in which the discrete brushed drums and rhythm guitar initially provide reliably straight 4-in-a-bar beats, while the piano tumbles about tripleting and syncopating against this framework. Then other instruments, notably sax, trombone and trumpet, perform similarly athletic interludes atop the structure. Swing, which was all-conquering in the 1930s and 40s, and which Duke Ellington, doubtless tired of explaining what made jazz tick, coquettishly refused to define in his mammoth hit of 1931, "It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing," subsequently bequeathed its shuffling triplets to rock and roll. The handover can be plotted in stages, starting with a slow, dreamy triplet shuffle in jazz violinist Joe Venuti's 1929 track Apple Blossoms, then in a more frantic version in his Really Blue of 1930. The third stage in its journey to world domination has it transferred into the chordal texture provided by piano and guitar, which had hitherto been the home of the steady four-crotchet beat, as in 1 o'clock jump. This shift was in evidence as early as 1931 in Venuti's Tempo di Modern Age, in which the seeds of rock and roll were truly sown. It was precisely this triplet pattern, the one we've tracked from Humpty Dumpty in the 1640s, which became the bedrock of the rock and roll shuffle style. The triplet configuration of chords driving the four beats in a bar rock shuffle can be heard in songs as diverse as Fats Domino's monster hit Blueberry Hill of 1950 and Leonard Cohen's Alleluia of 1984. A footnote to the riotously successful triplet shuffle of swing is that the one style it didn't fully colonise was, perhaps ironically, the family tree of dance forms that began with the contradance and habanera. The habanera's strict, dotted, 3+1 pattern was handed down to the Spanish zarzuela, the Cuban danzón, the Brazilian mashish, and the Argentinian and Uruguayan tango. For the tango, with its abrupt machismo movements, its upright body posture, tight physical language, and the participants' high-heeled shoes, the more rigid definition of the dotted pattern was much more suitable than the deliberately casual atmosphere of the more liquid, loose triplets. We shall return to the far-reaching influence of Cuban danzón and other related forms in the next chapter. The transition from the chaotic, individualistic, rough-and-ready nature of 1920s jazz to a more streamlined form of swing in the 1930s was mirrored in other musical genres. A new breed of book-based musical emerged on Broadway, that is, shows with a clear narrative and dramatic shape, not just vague show business storylines on which to hang unrelated songs. And hastily cobbled together reviews with random extravagant dance routines were shown the exit signs, at least temporarily. Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II's Showboat of 1927 was a turning point in this respect, demonstrating what a well-written, clearly structured musical with a thought-provoking plot could be. Showboat is many things, full of memorable tunes, daring for the 1920s in its confrontation of racial issues, emotionally rich, inescapably enjoyable, and utterly sincere. But what it is not is a reflection of the jazzy, popular song style of the day. Its songs, with the one exception of Can't Help Lovin' That Man, are firmly grounded in a sentimental operetta and music hall milieu. They could all have been composed at any time in the previous 50 years. It's as if Duke Ellington, Fats Waller and Louis Armstrong simply had never existed. Much of Showboat's attitude to poverty and racial stereotypes seems to us somewhat patronising, but this was the 1920s, and at its core is a well-intentioned heart. Call it sentimental, but the 20th century Broadway musical was created by Jewish men and women whose families had, almost universally, been offered a lifeline of opportunity via immigration from Europe to the United States. Their unflinching belief in the transformative effects of populist American art forms, such as the musical and the movie, was heartfelt, and audiences then as now knew that a Kern and Hammerstein or Rodgers and Hammerstein musical was a cynicism-free zone. The 1930s saw some giants of musical comedy, as it mostly was at that time, straddle the twin worlds of Broadway and Hollywood, among them George and Ira Gershwin, Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hart. But the growing commercial confidence of Broadway and Hollywood musicals and of their songwriters blossomed at a time when classical music was struggling to find a sense of purpose beyond mere experimentation. While classical composers may not have felt in direct competition with the glitz of 1920s Broadway or 1930s Hollywood, it can't have escaped their notice that the marketplace for new music was increasingly crowded and competitive. In a handful of decades, new media had entered the fray. One can't help wondering whether the stage spectacles of underwater Rhine maidens in Wagner's Rheingold in Munich, 1869, or of a glass palace on the moon in Offenbach's Voyage dans la Lune in Paris, 1875, would have attracted as much excited attention had the audiences had the option of seeing the same wonders evoked on film. Added to classical composers' discomfort was the prospect of some of their most conspicuously successful popular counterparts, such as Gershwin and Porter, threatening to set up shop in the serious field. Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue was followed by a string of orchestral commissions, including a piano concerto, and Cole Porter composed a fine ballet score within the quota for the Ballet Suédois in Paris in 1923. The 20th century put enormous pressure on classical composers to carve out a new role for themselves. One route open to the advance guard was to play with the musical possibilities of the surreal and the absurd. The term surrealist was first used to describe a ballet, specifically one infamous collaboration between composer Eric Satie, painter Pablo Picasso, and writer-dramatist Jean Cocteau, a clownish concoction called Parade that had its first performance in Paris in May 1917. Its series of street entertainers in jesting, facetious mood was not without its innovations, from the bizarre juxtaposition of seemingly unrelated scenes and the disruption of any expectation of a narrative to Picasso's cardboard costumes that made dancing all but impossible, and in-joke mockery of impresarios and audiences who would put on or watch any old tat without discernment. Parade's innovations, though, ought to be seen in the context of the times. Its buffoonish hooey and end-of-the-pier music may have amused its creative team and some critics, but with the benefit of hindsight, its timing seems tasteless and incomprehensible. Just 100 miles away from the sumptuous Théâtre du Châtelet, in Paris's fashionable first arrondissement, the catastrophe of the Second Battle of the Aisne, which claimed 120,000 French lives in 2 weeks on the notorious Chemin des Dames, was turning into a rout and a wholesale mutiny with mass desertions. How cut off from reality had the arts world become that Cocteau and his colleagues deemed the up-yours camp of Parade, which had all the hallmarks of a hastily thrown together student review, an appropriate public offering in May 1917. The Parisian arts clique at whom it was targeted were both scandalised and offended by it, and the very fact that it was targeted at them rather than at, say, soldiers on leave from the front precludes it from any defence that it was intended as harmless escapism, like the contemporaneous, tuneful smash hit Hookem that was Oscar Asche and Frederick Norton's Chu Chin Chow in London's West End. It's not that slapstick distraction in itself was necessarily out of place between 1914 and 1918. Charlie Chaplin made over 40 films during the First World War, after all. But attempts by musicological and arts commentators to justify the meaning of staging Parade in the midst of a devastating war have never ceased to sound tenuous and desperate. Daniel Albright, Harvard professor of literature, described it as one of the profoundest responses to the Great War, precisely because it flew in the face of current events, cocking a snook at the solemnity of the 1917 mood, striking a pose he described in his Untwisting the Serpent, Modernism in Music, Literature and Other Arts, 2000, as cultivated apathy. But explanations of the fiasco by Jean Cocteau and poet Guillaume Apollinaire, who wrote the programme note as well as coining the expression surréalisme, do not indicate that thought anything like as deep as Albright suggests went into Parade. Apollinaire claimed half-heartedly that there was a patriotic aspect to the endeavour, celebrating the new simplicity and clarity of French style in opposition to the complicated pretension of the German. But this observation came far too late to be taken seriously. Satie had begun his move towards simplicity and clarity 30 years earlier with his Gymnopédie. Fauré had started writing songs in the newly purified sound 10 years before that, and Saint-Saëns' decidedly un-German playful mockery of musical pretension, The Carnival of the Animals, was composed in 1886. Cocteau's main aim, it would seem, was to shock Parade's de facto producer, Sergei Diaghilev, who had challenged Cocteau to astonish him. Though music's flirtation with surrealism was short-lived, how can such an unreal art form ever really have had any relationship with surrealism? One controversial aspect of Parade's score had some coincidental forward momentum. This was its integration, against the composer's wishes, as it happens, of non-musical sound effects into the score. The rhythmic qualities of these sounds, from typewriters to factory sirens, were exploited time and time again as the 20th century wore on, though it has to be said that the little-known Parade was not directly responsible for inspiring subsequent experiments. The most extreme early example of this industrial sound texture, premiered in 1922, was the Symfonia Gudkov, Symphony of Factory Sirens, by Russian composer and sound technician Arseny Avramov. As well as factory sirens, his symphony featured bus and car klaxons, the foghorns of a Soviet flotilla in the Caspian Sea, artillery guns, cannon, machine guns, pistols, supplied and played by an entire infantry regiment, ship's sirens, various steam whistles, and massed military bands and choirs. Aptly, it had its first performance in Baku, capital of Soviet Azerbaijan, and home to the Caspian Fleet. Other machine or found sound works of the period included Zavod, Symphony of Machines, by another Russian, Alexander Mosolov, the soundtrack to a Soviet film Enthusiasm, Symphonia Donbassa, in 1931, and solo typewriters joined the orchestra for Leroy Anderson's The Typewriter, 1950, and Krzysztof Penderecki's Fluorescences of 1962. Musical surrealism and attempts at finding what the future of sound might be ran, somewhat surprisingly, alongside another avenue being explored by classical composers in the 1920s, rummaging around in music's attic. Led by Stravinsky and Sergei Prokofiev, both composers disorientated by the year zero politics that followed the Russian Revolution and Civil War, they took to resurrecting antique musical forms and sometimes actual pieces by long-forgotten 17th and 18th century composers, and adding their own 20th century slant to them. In a sense, this process, given the fancy title neoclassicism by music historians, was at times nothing more elaborate than plagiarism. Stravinsky and Prokofiev, though, were engaged in something more than simply regurgitating old styles. They tampered with them along the way, as if to modernise the originals, inserting into them, for example, unexpected and anachronistic dissonances. Playing merry havoc with the styles of previous eras was a perfectly legitimate game to play, but it's hard not to draw the conclusion that experimental modernism was running out of steam to be replaced with the musical equivalent of repro furniture. Stravinsky had mischievous fun pillaging music's dusty back catalogue with the ballet Pulcinella for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe Company in 1920. It coquettishly combines 1920s chutzpah and 18th century courtly dance, quoting along the way actual music by 18th century Italian composers. Diaghilev and Stravinsky believe the manuscripts from a Naples library to be the work of Giovanni Pergolesi, 1710-36, but it has since transpired that they were in fact mostly by the more obscure Carlo Ignazio Monza and Domenico Gallo, who died in 1739 and 1768, respectively. Pulcinella is sparklingly inventive with its source material, but it is nevertheless the musical equivalent of placing the Art Deco spire of Manhattan's Chrysler Building